Hey you, thanks for tuning into the Waiting List podcast. I'm Long Long.
I'm Daniel.
And I'm Jacqueline, and we are three watch friends with a healthy obsession for watches.
So sit back and relax with us while we chat with collectors, industry giants, and share some good vibes.
Welcome back, guys. On the podcast today, we're lucky to have Benoit Mintiens. He is the founder of Resonance Watches. Welcome to the show, Benoit.
Thank you. Hello, Lum.
All right. So I want to talk about the first time I played with a Resonance watch, and it was at the MBNF Mad Gallery in Dubai.
Okay.
At that time, I was starting into like more serious watch collecting. Mm-hmm. And I started to explore brands outside of like Rolex, AP, and the big ones. And I just remember being super fascinated with the piece, despite them having brought out all the other MBNF pieces. And that mm-hmm. honestly says a lot, because I'm a huge MBNF fan. So for mm-hmm. you to like, well, for me anyways, to be like, okay, hold on, what is this? It means that I really thought it was a very interesting watch. The sad part about my experience was I left with very little understanding. Either I didn't ask enough questions, but I remembered the design. So I'm going to use this chance to like fill in all the gaps of like, you know, what I want to understand.
The approach that Resonance has compared to, I think, most brands, and in particular MBNF, is that we look at the product as designers. My background mm-hmm. is industrial design. And for an industrial designer, the most, I think, important aspect of a product is its function. Mm-hmm. When you look at a product from its functional point of view, from this functional point of view, and in particular, if you look at watches and mechanical watches, because that's the subject now, you will notice that I think very little has been done from a functional point of view since many years. The approach we have, and to make it very pragmatical here, is that, for example, the way you read the time. There's not many brands that are really thinking about how do you read the time on our watches. They are maybe a lot more busy with how do I look with this watch, or what does it show, or what does it express, but maybe less from this really functional point of view, like how can I read the time in the most effective way. And when a Resonance strikes your eyes, it's because we have been thinking about these aspects. I'll give you a few examples. You will have noticed that on the Resonance, the dial does not have hands. It's all discs that are coplanar, so meaning that they all are in the same layer and they all rotate inside each other. The concept comes from the idea that you can more easily read information that is two-dimensional, so like on paper, for example, you can or a screen, because we're looking at a screen now, so that's quite easy to read, and it's very obvious that if you would make things three-dimensional to read something, it becomes a lot more complicated. Imagine yourself, the words in your journal would start to float above the paper, a bit like hands do on a traditional watch. It would become a lot more complicated to read. So what we have done is we applied the logics of reading on paper, but here reading on a screen, because the screen also adds the dynamic aspect of it. So it moves, it can move. Try to do is to make a screen, but mechanical. That's where the concept comes from, basically.
Yeah, I truly like fascinated by this, because I read about how Harvard approached you guys and then did the experiment to see, would it be easier to read your watch, like in terms of speed compared to other watches? But I think the thing that
Not only speed, only precision.
But I think the thing that like I actually want to know is because when you tell somebody time, right, you say, hey, let's meet at, for example, it's 8:07 p.m. here in Asia. So you would say 8:07. So you would go hours first. But why did you go minutes first?
Because usually you know the hour you're in. So when you read the time, when you have a meeting, for example, you're walking towards a meeting or you have a meeting in maybe a couple of minutes, but you don't know how much. What you do, you check your watch, and basically your brain has been trained in such a way that you don't actually read out the real indication that the hand is giving, but you read out an angle, and your brain transformed this angle. So the difference between the angle of the hand and, for example, 60 minutes, this angle will tell you how much time you have. It's not measured in minutes. It's not measured. It's measured in the appreciation you have about the angle that you read. Do you follow me?
Yeah, I understand.
So if the angle is very small, you have little time. If the angle is large, you have a lot of time. But of course, this also relates to the fact that time is a relative element. And so when you're in a hurry and you feel you are under time pressure, this angle is becoming very, very important for you. And so the reason why we took the minutes is because usually you know the hour you're in. You know we have a meeting at 2, but I'm still walking towards the meeting. How long do I have? How much angle have I left? So a watch is basically an image that is projected to you, and your brain transformed this image into your orientation in time.
Okay.
And so it's really, that's why we took the minutes, because it's the minutes. 80% of the time you're checking the minutes. You're not really checking the hours. By the way, you can test it. Just read the time. One day, maybe you have a meeting and you say, I remember I had this call with Benoit. Well, check and think then, okay, what was the hours? Well, you will absolutely have no clue because your brain filters it out. It only search for the information you need at that time. And it's usually the minutes.
Okay. I suddenly thought about something else. So I know you designed when you were in your previous like job, you designed a lot of things. So like you were part of teams that designed luggages, trams, medical devices. Mm-hmm. So two questions actually. My question is about aircraft cabins, because I think you guys are considering a lot of things that the normal like consumer, we don't see. So what are the actual challenges in designing aircraft cabins that we haven't thought about? Because I think we only look at, okay, there's lack of space. So what is something else that we can spot next time we fly?
On that project, what is interesting, we had a little bit more luxury because it was a first class cabin. So it was not an economic seat where you are as many as possible on 1 square meter. So the idea that we had, the starting concept of this project was, or at least that's how we approached it, was to say, well, you can buy a very, very expensive ticket from whatever, Tokyo to Paris. It will cost you a fortune. But at arrival, you will still be jet lagged. And so how is your experience? So on the flight, you're happy because, you get champagne, you get this, you get that. And there are persons, people that are helping you all the time and asking you what you want. You're pampered, basically. But suddenly, when you're outside the plane, suddenly the jet lag kicks in. You feel really bad. So is this a good service? Is this a good experience that you had in the end by paying such an expensive ticket just to have a little bit more caviar than the others? So what we thought is, how can we modify your biorhythm during the flight so that at arrival, your you are adapted biologically to the condition you need to be in when you arrive. Let me give you an example. So okay. when you arrive in the plane, mm-hmm. there are three questions basically that you get, and you all have these screens, and the screen just asks you one thing. It says, "What will you do at arrival?" And there are three options. One is sleep. Second is enjoy my time. Mm-hmm. Third, work. So, mm-hmm. and depending on what you answer, the algorithm in your room, in your cabin, will start to modify all the parameters so that when you arrive, you all or feel sleepy, or you feel super fit to go to a meeting, or you feel like relaxed to go to something that you like to do. That's and nice. How do you do that? Is by modifying all the parameters around you. For example, the mixture of air that you get, the mm-hmm. type of food and when you get the food, and the number of calories, for example, or all the other elements that are in your food will be adapted so that your body well starts to react on that. What you drink, the temperature in your room, the light, the type of light that you have, the hardness of your seat, or mm-hmm. We also developed we didn't do that, but we took it from a study where you can make pillows that make you sleep immediately because of certain vibrations. So yeah. there are many, many parameters that you can play with that will have a certain impact on your biorhythm. And so that was really the idea, is to say, okay, you get into a certain a kind of conditioned environment that will mm-hmm. condition you for what you are planning to do after you leave the plane.
Wow, that's really like, so has this been adopted, or these are just
concepts? I left the company when they were making the prototypes. So I'm afraid I never saw the finished thing, and I guess they didn't do it all the way as usually, you know. It's that's the unfortunate thing about being a designer.
Dan?
I think my first contribution to this podcast is, what is that pillow?
Yeah.
I really want to buy that pillow.
Well, like to be able
to perform, I sleep really well anyway, and to the jealousy of my partner and all my friends, probably including Long Long, like I'm gone in 60 seconds. But just because you're gone in 60 seconds, it's not always like quality sleep, mm-hmm. right? So I'm for, you know, I've read the book by Matthew Walker called Sleep, and the quality of sleep, how it improves your life. You know, when you do get quality sleep, you just, everything's better.
Yeah.
So please, send me that.
Well, you know how long ago that was?
I will actually buy one.
That's like 15 years ago I did that. So I really, 12 years ago, between 12 and 15 years ago. So I'll need to search it, but I'm pretty sure you can find it on the internet. If
that's amazing. I bet that made a lot of money. Yeah. It works.
I'm still amazed that if they do adopt these ideas, the details that go into it, because right now when I do long haul flights, they do all the things that they should do, give you pajamas, slippers, blankets, all these things. But then I realized, okay, well, because I have trouble sleeping on the plane, even if it's a flat bed. So I will think to myself, okay, I actually bring another blanket, so then the blanket feels weighted, and I do a bunch of things to help myself sleep. So I always think about it whenever I'm flying. I'm like, what can I do to make it seem more like I'm at home?
Every company has different seats. They sleep differently. So it's really you never know. Well, unless you always fly with the same company, but I have to say sometimes beds, even the flat ones, it seems it was not designed for me. It must be some kind of human being. But
No. I'm telling you, because I don't worry, you're not the only one, because I'm small. And I'm like, if I'm struggling and I look around and it's like big white men, like European men, I'm like, I don't know how they're sleeping. Yeah.
I'm asleep before the plane's even taken off. I don't know
But
why.
the
Like, I don't know if it's there's an
yeah.
oxygen change or something. Even if I sometimes I tell myself I'm not gonna fall asleep. I
No,
can't help
mine's in
myself.
me.
I'm just like gone.
I mean, you can immediately feel the temperature gets super cold anyways. It's
Yeah.
like they're doing a bunch of things that I'm like, well, I guess they want people to just go to sleep. Okay,
Yeah.
but
Cooling
yeah.
down your body is an element to get a sleep, huh? So that's
Yeah.
one of the things, of course.
Okay, so back to your watches.
Yeah.
So I well, one of the things that the your watches are known for, well, not the, I mean, later on you introduced using oil for light refraction, right? Was
Yeah.
this an idea that you had learned from another industry, and how, or was it inspired by something else you designed before?
Well, we are about to introduce a book about it's called a catalogue raisonné, so it means it's a book with every watch we designed so far. It's for collectors. To have kind of background information about the watch they want to purchase or they have or whatever. And during the writing of that book, I asked myself, but where does the idea comes from putting oil in a watch for me? And actually, I think I found it. As a kid, my father very often, nearly every summer, he rented a sailing boat in the Mediterranean Sea. And so we went off for a few weeks every summer. And for sure, that's in the 80s, beginning of the 80s. And at that time, there was no GPS. There were no interactive maps. All these things did not exist. And so you relied on the compass at night because we did crossings, like 24-hour crossings. And I had to do the night shifts very often. And your only beacon is your compass. It's the only thing that you have because in the middle of the sea, there's no reference. There's no light, how do you call it, light tower or reference point on the shore because you don't see the shore. So the only reference you have is the stars. But then it needs to be clear, and your compass. That's it. That's what. So you're focused on that compass because if you are for like 10 hours seeing nothing, no shore for 10 hours, if you go away from that angle, well, you will end up in a spot that is not the one you expect. And it's very hard if it because it's for us it always we went always to other places so we yeah you don't know where you are well you don't recognize the shore and so it was quite and so yeah I think it has burned my retina this vision of this liquid filled glass ball with something that moves inside. And the little red light, because at night it's red, like in the submarines, not to blind your eyes. And so this idea of well, this vision all the time, I think it must come from there.
Oh, that's honestly, that's an unexpected answer. Because I know you talk a lot about how, as humans, we find it easier to adopt things that we see like in nature. So colors, shapes, lines, and so on. So I always thought you probably thought about like something from the trees or like something else, oil from a leaf and stuff. So yeah, that was
It
unexpected.
comes. I think it comes from there because, yeah, very often people ask me, "Yeah, why? Where do you get it from?" And I don't know. I just had the idea. I'm gonna fill a watch with oil, and probably it's gonna look cool. But yeah, then you need to do it. Huh?
Okay. And going back to when you first started, I've always been interested with how brands position themselves because, to be honest, your first watch wasn't exactly entry level price, but neither was it way out of reach. So, did you price it and think to yourself, I think there is enough people that are going to pay and appreciate this product?
Well, I made many mistakes, long as you know. Well, you don't know maybe, but I'm not from the watch industry. So and I have no one in my surroundings that was related to this business. So for me, it was very hard to have these kind of very basic informations like what are the margins for a retailer? Mm-hmm. I had no idea. How much should I earn on a watch as a company? How much should that be? It was, where do you get this information? And so in the beginning, it was a bit difficult for me to define the price. I knew what it cost. I knew the cost of the watch because I knew the production cost. But then how much should I add? Because people will ask me, what's the public price? Before you have any retailer and you never talk to anyone because it's your first show, you have no idea how much you should position the price of the watch. So I had to adapt the price after my first show. I was 25% too low to be able to pay the retailer his margin. So that was my first mistake and experience with trying to position the price. And then you asked me, how do you define it? At Ressence, we work differently. What we do is we take the cost of the watch and we apply a standard multiplicator. So we don't say, now I want a watch that is 25,000. No, we say, okay, how much would that watch cost? Knowing that now that we are a bit further and that we have watches in our collection, we can say, okay, we can target a certain price. That means that our cost should be that. That means that you can do this on the watch, but you cannot add this and this and this feature because this feature costs too much to produce. So this is a bit the way we approach it today. But in the beginning, it was like for example, when I launched the Type 3 for the first time, I designed it, I made the components, and I said, okay, this is going to be the price because this is the cost of the watch. It really, the approach is a bit different now.
All right.
I've got a few basic questions. The logo, the hand.
Yeah.
What's the idea behind that?
Yeah. Actually, it comes from a legend. So as you said, Lung, we are, and Daniel, we are based in Belgium. And the city we are in is Antwerp. So it's a harbor city. And actually, it's a city already very active in the Middle Ages. And in the Middle Ages, Antwerp was a bit comparable to Venice, probably less beautiful, but the same principle that the streets were little canals. So today it's all pavement, but in the Middle Ages, it was water. And so all the traders, they all came with boats to the city. And in the Middle Ages, there was a huge giant standing at the entry of the city. And with 1 foot on each side of the river. So every boat had to pass under his legs. And of course, he asked money to all these sailors. And these sailors, actually, they didn't want to give him money, but they had no choice because if they did not give money, he would sink the boat. So every time he asked money until one day, one of a local king, he was fed up with it, and he said, okay, if he asks money, if he reaches out, I will just cut his hand off. And as all good middle-aged stories, it's always a bit bloody. So he took the hand. Well, actually, he took a finger because the hand was so big. He took a finger of the hand, and he cut off the hand, and he threw it. And so the name of the city, Antwerpen, they say the name comes from hand, in Dutch, Belgium, in Antwerp, we speak Dutch. So we have Antwerpen. Hand is hand, and then werpen is throwing. So Antwerpen, that's how we say Antwerp in Flemish. So it's throwing the hand. So the logo of the city is also a little hand. So it's a little bit about our geographical origin. But I also thought it was interesting because when we design the watch, I explain you that we look at the functionality. but we certainly look at the relationship. When I design a watch, I design the relation. Before I design the physical watch, I design the relationship that you will have with that watch. Mm-hmm. It's a fundamental element. If you want to have a positive relationship with a product, whatever it is, here in this case, it's a watch, but can be something else, you always have to design the relationship. And so the hand is a good way to also represent this relationship that you have. The hand, for me, is a symbol of that dimension in our creative process.
Okay. Mm. I've got another question, which is, how many pieces do you make like a year? What's the production number?
It changes every year. Last year we did 650. We delivered 650 watches. Yeah. But we had some production issues last year. There was a very important machine that produces, let's say, an important part of us for us that had a breakdown because of a maintenance error. And so we couldn't deliver the amount of watches that we were planning to deliver. So I hope this year we will have a better increase than the year before.
Okay, so obviously there's some mechanical components in your watch. A lot of like independents, they trade on the fact that, you know, they do everything by hand and therefore mm-hmm. it's impossible for them to mass manufacture.
Yeah.
But is that the case with Resonance? No. If the demand picked up, would you be able to create more and more and more?
Well, let's not be naive, Daniel. All these components are produced by CNC machines. Huh? It's sometimes the finish that is done by hand. Mm-hmm. And you really pay for it a lot. At Resonance, from my background, one of the other things that influences how the watches look is the fact that I'm an industrial designer. And so I always look at the product from an industrial point of view. Even though our products are complicated, and they are really very complicated, but they still are industrial products. They're produced industrially. They're produced by milling machines, by CNC machines, by turning machines, etc. All the processes that we use are repeatable in that sense that we don't depend, of course, except the watchmakers. We don't depend on certain trades, crafts that would be maybe impossible to find or whatever. On the other hand, what we also believe is that we try to make a product that is the finish is super high, but mm-hmm. coming from an industrial process. So it's a bit different than what I think many independent watchmakers are doing. They are, and I explain you why, where this difference comes from. Most brands were created by watchmakers. Most watch mm-hmm. brands were created by watchmakers. It's obvious, of course, because when you're a watchmaker, it's logical that one day you say, okay, now I'm going to create my own watch brand. And so for a watchmaker, the most important aspect, the most important part, the most important focus when he creates a watch is the movement. That's the core of his trade, the movement. And so he will always start from the movement. And this will get, I think, 90% of his attention. And then he will have to add a dial and hands and put it in a case to protect this movement. But the movement is the core of his trade. So he creates the watch from the inside towards the outside. Whereas I'm an industrial designer, so I don't start with the movement. I start with you. And I ask myself, why do you buy a watch? What does it do for you? What's the purpose of this thing on your wrist? What is your context? Where do you live in? How do you live? Why do you need a watch? And so I start from the outside, because a watch, the word says it, you watch at it. So it's something that happens on the outside. The information, the function of a watch happens on the outside of the watch. It's like a screen. It happens on the outside. So the outside is the core of my business. How do I read the time? How do I express the time in the most efficient way. So my trade, my concentration, my core business is on the outside of the watch. And then I start to dig into the watch, because of course you can have a certain graphical representation of time, but then of course you need to animate it. You need gears, you need stones, you need ball bearings, etc. And really the end for me is the movement. The movement is there only to drive the whole system. Our movements are super simple. They only have one axle. It's the minutes. And all the rest, there's nothing else. It's only minutes on these movements. So you cannot even use them in a normal watch. And so when your core is the movement, it's obvious that you are going to put more energy in the finishing of that movement. It's logical. When you're a watchmaker, that if the movement is the core of what you do, you try to put all your effort and all your trade and all the craftsmanship that you have, you'll put it in the movement. Whereas for us, the core is the dial. So we put all the energy in the dial. We put all the energy on what will generate the functional aspect of the product. And sometimes that's the discs, it's the titanium, it's the Luminova that you need, it's the oil that you put inside because it will take away the refraction. It's maybe the e-crown technology that we use because it will take away the fact that you need to set the watch anymore or wind the watch anymore. So it's all functional things that that is where we focus ourselves.
I have a lot to say. So Dan, you can ask your question, but I also want to just say, like, because of how he explained it, it's really underselling how crazy, because it's starting to sound like the movement is secondary. But if you hear how the e-crown functions, you will be like, why is this thing? I know it's patented already, so I'm not worried, but like, why is no one talking about this every single day? Like, it's so mind blowing. But yeah, Dan, come in.
No, it's kind of on the same vein, but the Swiss watch industry, the watch industry in general is heavily Swiss, especially the luxury side. And it's an industry that doesn't change very quickly. Mm. And you've come from this industrial engineer background with a different time-telling concept plus an e-crown. Mm. I'm just curious to know, when you brought your product into the industry, from people within the industry as opposed to consumers, what was the feedback? Did you face a lot of resistance?
Actually, in the beginning, not so much. I think people were intrigued because the e-crown is one thing, but it's the dial system that is what you see. E-crown, you don't see it. If it's not active, you see a normal mechanical watch running. It's the e-crown, just to answer you long, e-crown is actually a technology that we developed that will do all the functions that you do with a crown, but it will do it automatically. Mm-hmm. When you don't do something with the crown, you don't notice there is e-crown inside the watch. To come back to you, Daniel, now I forgot the key of the question.
So Dan is wondering if you had people were supportive.
Yeah. Or
were
so the reactions, yes. Yeah. So in the beginning, the reactions were quite positive. But when, and this particularly, when we introduced eCrown, then I got... it was at SIHH. It was still called SIHH at that time. And still, Richemont was the king at that time during the show. And I remember I had some directors from Richemont on my booth explaining me that such technology did not have its place in such a show. So I was a bit criticized about my approach. Of course, they did not understand that the key feature of that watch was the fact that the mechanical integrity was 100% respected in that watch, because we only touched the crown function. We did not touch the mechanical movement. From the mechanical movement from the barrel to the hand, there is a mechanical link that is never interrupted. When you set your mechanical watch, you don't interrupt the link between the barrel and your hands, and it's the same for a type 2. It's only the crown function that we have automated. It's a bit like in the car.
Yeah,
we had manual gearboxes, and then mm-hmm. suddenly came the automatic gearbox. Well, what we have done is we made an automatic gearbox for the same car. We did not change the car. We only put an automatic gearbox in that car.
Okay, so I had this whole argument yesterday with a bunch of watch collectors, and we were talking about how, so you come from a different background, so you design by dial first. And I actually was saying that if you think about F.P. Journe, everyone recognizes him as a watchmaker, but he designs his dial. Then he goes, what movement fits the dial? But of course, because he's a watchmaker, he's going to get less criticism. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is, if you look at F.P. Journe, they do have a piece that is a very similar, not 100% the same, but you know, you pick up the Elegante and it goes, you know, it immediately sets the time without you manually doing it.
Mm-hmm. That's a quartz.
That's a quartz. Yeah, I know. But what I'm saying is, because I kind of knew even before you answered, you probably got a bit of resistance after you introduced the e-crown, right? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, it's competition, right? And it's healthy competition even. Mm-hmm. What I want to know is, since it's been patented, have the watch brands come back to you to say, can we use that too?
I had some demands. The technology is expensive. And you have to know that the economics behind larger corporations, because it was not independent brands that came to me, it was a larger corporations. The larger brands, the let's say the mainstream high-end brands, but for them this technology is too expensive, because the mm-hmm. multiplicators they have on their watches is just are a fraction of that. So they earn a lot of, well, they make more money on a watch. Of course they spend a lot more money on communication than we do. This needs to come from somewhere. But their economic models are very different than ours. We still, and that's the beautiful thing about independent watchmaking, I think that's one of the reasons why people are attracted to independent watchmaking, it's because we still sell real products. Yeah. We don't sell brands. Most people don't know Ressence, and that's the case for, I think, all my colleagues. So when someone buys an independent brand, he really buys a product. And so for us, the added value is there, whereas these larger corporations, their added value is in the branding, their added value is in the marketing. That's where they get their added value from. The fact that people are ready to pay a lot of money for actually a product is pretty standard. They buy it for another reason. So mm-hmm. I am not critical about this type of business, because these larger corporations also create a market for us. We as independent brands, we are incapable of creating the demand. We live from the customers of these larger brands that are happy to go deeper, that go further into their knowledge and their their knowledge about watchmaking, but they need to start somewhere. Rare are those that buy an independent brand as their first watch. Usually you're first attracted to watchmaking by these huge brands. It generates something about it. Usually you buy it for reasons like social status or reassurance or whatever. There are other drivers that make you buy these products. Of course, you need to like it. It needs to look good on you, etc. So very often you buy it for the others. And when you buy a Ressence or an independent brand, but the Ressence in particular, you buy it for yourself first, because you know that no one will know No one will know in the street or in your office or whatever the people you want to impress. Well, they will not know what you're wearing, and so they will not associate you with a certain status because they don't know your status. They cannot read your status through these type of watches. So the way that we buy watches is very different, and what we live from as independent brands is our people that bought their watch for the others and start to buy the watch for themselves. And this is where we come in as a niche part of the industry. But we could not exist if there was not this larger corporation that created the demand, the attraction to the industry.
For the lack of like marketing you guys have done, you guys have some of like the coolest customers though. Like, yeah. I mean, like I read like Tony Fadell, our mutual friend, Mark Cho, like these are people that when you see the watch on them, you're like, what is this? This is actually really cool. And it makes you want to go look at it.
And my mutual friend, Jeff Bezos. Yeah.
Sorry, who? Daniel?
My mutual friend, Jeff Bezos. Doesn't he have one?
Yeah. He has one? He's a very
good friend of mine. Yeah. I thought he had one. Yeah.
But you should ask him.
He's not really my mutual friend.
You buy from him.
Well, you can send an email to the customer support and escalate it to it. Okay, I have a question that's related to, it's definitely a dumb question, but you guys released a watch that was like a pistachio color. I know you call it like jade, different greens. Everyone has a different name for green. But to me, it was like a pistachio kind of green color. Yeah. And the difficulty in getting to that color was that because you basically have to mix a bunch of metals or something. And I just want to understand, what is the difficulty? Like, why is it so hard to get a specific color?
Well,
how wide can the range go in terms of how wild these colors can go?
Another specificity of a Ressence watch, and certainly the dial, is that the components you see are actually technical parts. They're actually very complicated machined, five-axle machine components. They are so complex that 10 to 15 years ago, they were not impossible to produce in the way they are, because the machines did not exist to make these type of components. So just to give you an idea about the technical complexity, they are three-dimensional components. This is quite unique in the industry. You will rarely see a watch with a three-dimensional structure. All watches on the market, I would say, all except a few, all are 2D, two-dimensional and a half, meaning that all the axles in the watch are parallel to each other. Mm. But on a Ressence, there is not one single axle that is parallel to the other one, because they are all going through the virtual center of the domed dial. Mm. Maybe technical now. It means that instead of milling a hole with an X and a Y parameter and then drill the hole, for all watches in the world, it's like that. With a Ressence watch, you have an X, a Y, and a Z, plus an angle and a point where you come out that is defined by a X, a Y, and a Z. So all these elements make that we have a multiplication of the complexity of even drilling a hole. And I'm only talking about drilling a little hole. There is, of course, a lot more, because all these components are milled out of a block of titanium. It's not plates or something or stamped. It's all milled out of a block. Uh-huh. So I come back to your question with the color.
Yeah.
So these components, these discs, they are inside each other and they are 0.03 millimeters from each other. So the split line between the discs is 0.03 of a millimeter, they call it. That's not a lot. And when you have these type of space, well, any coating, any color that you would add to the technical part will be thicker than this 0.03 millimeter. So our only, in the beginning, our only way to color our parts is by using galvanic colors. That means it's a chemical treatment that mm-hmm. you do, electrolytical, to yeah. give a color, like a DLC or a PVD. You probably heard mm-hmm. about it because many, many people use these type of colorization. Mm-hmm. On top of that, and the problem that you have with these type of processes is they are quite difficult to repeat in time to have exactly the same color. So if we make a part and then we go back to the same company that does this coloring and we say, okay, can you make this part in the same color as the previous one? You can be sure it's not going to be exactly the same because of all the parameters that you have when you make this chemical process. So for most watches, it's not a problem because the dial is one part. It's just a disc and they finish it beautifully, but it's one part. With this, it's physically 9, 10, 12 different components that are 0.03 millimeter from each other. If there is any difference in color between those two, you will see it immediately.
Yeah.
So we have developed many, many, I would say, processes to make sure that we could reduce the difference as much as we could. Mm-hmm. But in the end, for colors like this, like the eucalyptus, as we call it, you call it pistache. You know, pistache is well, okay, anyway. So this color, you cannot have it in galvanic treatment. There is no galvanic color in that. Okay. It does not exist.
Yeah.
So we said, how can we have and a coating that is so thin that it will not influence the functionality of our watches? But also, on the other hand, be able to offer different colors than black or blue, because that's what you get when you do galvanic, black, blue, or gray, if you want. Well, the only option that you have is to develop yourself something. And so we developed a technology, took us 2 years to develop a technology that would allow us, it's a mixture between a coating and painting, and combined with a very specific way to apply it to make sure that we could have a very, very thin color. The pigments were also developed specifically for this because of the such a tiny, thin layer of coloring. So we developed basically, to say it in industrial terms, it's a coating that we apply to the components and that allows us to have many different colors. I think most colors we can offer now thanks to this technology that we developed.
Okay. I mean, because I know you care even up to the 0.03, the distance between the components and everything. But why is it all the watches are still at least like 40 mm and above?
Again, please.
Like all your watches from the first one till now.
Yeah.
They're still quite big. They're still 40 mm and above.
Yeah.
So is this something that you guys are going to think about changing or not changing? Because at the end of the day, I understand you want it to be legible, but you're also a brand that focuses a lot on functionality, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. So we are of course thinking of how can we reduce the size of the watch. Today it's 40, 41 actually is the smallest that we have. There are two things. First of all, it's 40 or 41 or 42 is a number that you associate with a certain size. If I tell you it's a 42 millimeter, you have a certain idea about how big that is on your wrist. But that's influenced or defined by the watches that you have tried on in a 42 millimeter. These watches had a crown. These watches had probably very big lugs. And so they feel very big on your wrist. Whereas when you look at a Ressence watch, it's very pure. There is no crown that sticks out. The lugs are very minimal, sometimes even not there. They're integrated in the case. And so a Ressence watch on your wrist usually feels 10 to 20, no, let's say 10% smaller than what you would actually think it looks. And so it's a little bit the handicap that we have is because, yeah, we have to write down the number, because if you measure the watch, yeah, you measure 42. And some people say, oof, 42, that's too big for me. But I would say try it, because you'll see it's going to feel like a 40 and a half or maybe a 41, depending on the model. Because of the shape, and the Ressence watches are very organic. And it's a very, very soft pebble, very often pebble shape.
Yeah.
Well, a pebble, if you would make it straight, if you would take the pebble and you would make it straight like a coin, the shape of a coin, it would look huge, the same pebble, only because of the rounded edges. It feels a lot smaller thanks to the rounded edges. And that's what we apply also to our watches. So they are big in millimeters, but they are visually smaller. But you need to try it on. You will immediately see, oh, is this 42? Well, everyone has the same reaction. Is this 42? I can believe it. It's like a 40 or 41. So it's really the perception that you get, and the perception is influenced by the shape of that we apply to our products.
All right. So the next 5 years, where is the brand going? What is the vision?
Yeah. What we have done is that I made a circle. And in that, and on the outside of that circle, I've positioned all the products, all the dimensions we want to have an answer for as a product. And so what we are doing now is to fill up the gaps. So we have already a few in the product range that we have already a few products that are corresponding to these different positions that we want to have as a brand, but there are still open ones. And so what we are working on now is, of course, we have the designs, we have the ideas, we have the concepts. But yes, you need a certain pace to get there. Huh? We're still a young brand. So we are now working on, and you will see in the coming years, you will see products that come in that you say, oh, Ressence is also going in that direction. Oh, Ressence is also trying to have a product that will answer this aspect, for example, or that will answer that aspect, for example. And so this is the way we approach it today. It's quite strategic and a little bit confidential.
I was at a dinner recently with Crayon, and those are releasing something, and of course they're not allowed to tell us anything. And then we're all sitting there and like, what hasn't been covered yet by the watch industry? And then being a girl, I was like, what about ovulation? Like people trying to get pregnant and then they need a watch that could like time it for them and stuff. But so I'm excited to see what you come up with. Yeah. Okay, my last question. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, it's all right. Sorry.
Okay. My last question is, it doesn't have to be the watch industry, but is there another product out there in the world that you think could be designed better? And what would you do?
It's very annoying to be an industrial designer, because in every product, you have the feeling there is something wrong.
Yeah.
They forgot something. They didn't think of this. They didn't think of that. Or very often a product is the result of many, many trade-offs. It's for sure the cost, but when you design a product, as a consultant, it was my first exercise I always did when I had a new customer. I went to his factory and I asked him, what can you make? What are the techniques that you have to make your products? Because very often, you can design something, but if they cannot make it in an efficient way, it makes no sense for them and they will not do it. Even though the product is superior, they will not do it.
Mm.
So the a product is always a compromise between many dimensions. And so it's easy when you are just looking at it and you say, this chair, it doesn't sit well. Well, yes, but maybe you forgot it's only $5. So maybe you should not say this. It sits really well for $5.
Yeah.
So it's really this thing. So yeah, I could go any product. I could say, well, I would improve this, or I would change that, or I would do that. But I also like the imperfection of things. I also appreciate these things. So it's a bit of a balance and a trade-off. And for sure, there are many things I can improve on my watches too. So I need to stay
consistent. Just to confirm, as a consumer, if I'm given three options, say a chair, there's a cheap one, a medium one, and an expensive one. The safest thing to do is to go for the medium.
depends on how it sits, no?
Yeah, but
I say, your home must be a very interesting place.
It's very traditional. It's no.
Oh, is it really traditional? So everything, you went traditional.
No, it's because I don't live alone here. Yeah, I'm not the only one.
That says a lot. That says a lot. So what there's you're saying always was compromise. Your recommendations didn't pass.
Yes, I have to admit, some did not pass indeed. Yeah, it's true.
I feel you. I think a lot of people listening to the podcast feel you.
Yeah, all the married man out there. All right. Thank you, Benoit. I really love what the brand is doing. Yeah.
Thank you.
And guys, if you have a chance, you really do have to see one in the flesh. I mean, the website's really cool, but I really think you have to really see one and it will really blow your mind. Well, I'll see you guys on the next one. And again, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Bye-bye.
As always, thank you for listening to the Waiting List podcast.
We hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have. And if you have any questions,
comments,
or feedback,
feel free to reach out to us at the Waiting List podcast on Instagram or via our private accounts.
We'll see you on the next one.
Bye.
Bye.